Let me just hang my hat on this hook.
Don't touch that lever.
Feels like the whole building has been thrown into the time vortex. We must be travelling backwards and forwards in time. The time vortex is both pink and blue.
No, that's the paint Hayden's been keeping for painting the nursery. It's spilled everywhere.
Quick, go to the computer console and check the flight unit control kit.
The flight unit control kit? I can't find it.
Just type in the initials, Mark. Don't you learn anything from Fifth Doctor stories?
Where are we heading?
It says, destination massive inrush of hot air, event one.
Event one? Hot air inrush? Oh no! We're travelling backwards to episode one of the Diddly Dumb podcast!
No! We'll never survive that! I've heard it!
Excuse me, Ian, you're talking about the start of something which has brought joy and entertainment to millions.
Priorities, Doc, please.
I thought episode one of this podcast was a myth.
Almost. As listeners will know from our average episode length, the Diddly Dumb podcast is never-ending, without a beginning, a middle, or an end.
Oh, I see. Like the plot of Flux.
Not quite as bad as that. You see, in quantum theory, the Diddly Dumb podcast is an infinitely long shaggy dog story. So it follows that the podcast has neither a beginning nor an end. Podcast one never happened, and our final podcast only exists as an eternal punchline in the mind of God.
And as any audience numbers divided by infinity come to zero, it must follow that our audience base becomes too small to have a physical existence, and only exists as a mathematical concept on our listener rating spreadsheet on the Whosium computer. It's only by constantly muttering that we're the fourth best Doctor Who podcast that the illusion of an actual listenership is maintained at all.
And if we ever stop, the spreadsheet crashes and we crash with it. We call it Excel transfer computation.
That's all very interesting, but how are we going to escape collision with your non-existent Podcast One?
There's only one option. We have to eject mass from the Whosium to fling us out of the time vortex. Here we are. Four switches, four bedrooms. Mark's, Hayden's, mine, and the guest bedroom. You've got to choose one, Mark.
I can't do it. It's too momentous a decision.
You've got to! Just close your eyes and press one of the buttons. Do it!
Oh.
Oh. Looks like it worked. We're saved! Tell us the worst, Mark. Whose bedroom got ejected?
They all seem to be here. Looks like I pressed another button by mistake.
So, which room got ejected?
Oh no, we've lost Hayden's jam pantry. He'll be furious!
Of course! We were forgetting our basic quantum physics. There are only two infinite masses in creation. The average length of a Diddly Dumb podcast and...
Hayden's jamminess, of course.
Isn't your ego also an infinite mass, Doc?
Not anymore. I actually do check our audience figures.
Next time, could I have some proper character lines, please? I feel like I'm only here to ask plot questions for you to explain.
We can't come up with character moments for everyone. Think yourself lucky. If Hayden had been here to make a foursome, you'd have had to spend the podcast asleep.
Right, well, now that we've moved the Whosium's emergency time shift control away from the hat stand, we can say, happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 188 of the Diddly Dumb podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. Who's muttering? Stop it. I'm Doc.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Ian.
And this is Joshua.
Greetings, Professor Falcon.
Again, during Hayden's sabbatical, we welcome friend of the show, Mr. Ian Winterton. Hi, Ian.
Hello, Ian. Hey.
Pleasure to be here.
Mark's laptop gave up the ghost the other day, so he's now podcasting via a gaming setup. So if you want to imagine him, listeners, as a sort of one of the operators sitting in the NORAD control centre on War Games, it's pretty much like that. Right, so what has been happening since... In fact, it was not that long since we last assembled, was it, Ian? You were with us in July.
Hmm.
I'll tell you one thing I've been wanting to ask you ever since I started editing that podcast. In summing up your life for us, you told us that following your university days in Crewe, you travelled around a bit before settling back in the Northwest. And I think I must have assumed at the time that a technical error had caused me to mishear. But later, during the edit, I was thunderstruck. Thunderstruck I was. Did you actually say that you'd spent time in Khartoum?
Yes, I did. I spent a year in Khartoum.
Please elaborate.
I saw the Millennium, actually not in Khartoum, but in Port Sudan, as it turned out. But yeah, it's I did some teaching. I'd always wanted to do that kind of thing, and I finally got around to doing it properly. Yeah, so my time in Sudan, 1999 to 2000, is a bit like Jeremy Corbyn and his mother being at Cable Street. I just don't talk about it very often. I on about it every opportunity. Because it really is quite amazing to go to Sudan in 1999 and be told, we go to a chicken shop and I sat in a chair and it was, oh, you're sitting in Osama's seat. And apparently I'd picked the exact same seat that Bin Laden always sat in before he was ousted from the country and made to go and live in Afghanistan. So it was very strange when I was one of the few people in the West who knew who Osama Bin Laden was when 9/11 happened and was, in fact, talking about him the day 9/11 happened. But yeah, I could go on about it a lot. But it's a crazy, crazy... all of world history seems to intersect in Khartoum. And maybe it does everywhere you go. From Islamism to the British Empire to Egyptian stuff, the Romans, everything seems to cross at that point. And it is at the blue and the white Nile. So, yeah, so I think it had quite a big effect on my life. And obviously currently in the news for hideous reasons.
Hmm.
So for those of us whose experience of the country has been not really gone beyond an occasional watching on a Sunday afternoon of Gordon of Khartoum, is it all sand?
There's a lot of sand. It's a weird thing. Because of the British, it's had water drinkable from the tap for a long, long time.
All right.
But that water is always full of sand. So whenever you sort of fill up your water bottle and go out, you're just used to the fact that the bottom half is where all the sand is sort of settling. Right. Which is all this red sand. Yeah, no, there's a lot of sand. A lot of sand in Khartoum. It's an amazing place.
It sounds amazing. I think that the Manchester and its environs should be proud that you eventually settled there at the end.
Well, Khartoum isn't a tourist destination, to say the least.
Whereas Manchester, on the beach... I was going through this list of places you'd been after Crewe, and it was London, New York, Leeds. And I was thinking of that... I miss the city I love, but I've been having an affair with London, New York, Leeds... And Khartoum, if I may tell.
I missed off Ljubljana as well. That was another teaching gig during the Yugoslav War.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, right.
Or towards the end of it.
I might well end up back in Manchester myself one day, but I don't know if they'd welcome me back with open arms through the door, so... God, no Khartoum, that was... It was that Charlton Heston, wasn't it?
Charlton Heston. Do you know what? I've never seen it, but it's Charlton Heston and... Is it O'Toole as well? Was one of them blacked up?
No, it's Olivier who's blacked up as the Mardy.
That's the Olivier, yeah, that's right.
Or,
yeah.
To use Corporal Jones' vernacular, the Mad Mardy.
Well, I never know, but I always think us saying in the north when we say, oh, he's gone a bit Mardy, I think that comes from the Mardy. I think it does, but I've never found confirmation.
Brilliant.
Oh, you Mardy bum.
A world with no room for the Gordons is a world that will return to the sands.
I always thought that's a really That'd make a really good jingle for a gin advert. Now, the big thing that's been happening, well, two big things have been happening in news lately. A few days ago, it was announced that hundreds of Doctor Who episodes are being made available on iPlayer for the first time. I must admit, I've always found it rather irritating that iPlayer only seems to have stuff post-Rose. Viewers will have the opportunity to watch the show's entire 60-year run.
I've just bought shares in ITVX as well.
I can't understand how they're on ITV.
It's because of BritBox.
Oh, of course, yes.
We've been in the interim period where everything that was on BritBox had migrated to ITVX, and now many things are coming to an end, including, I presume, Doctor Who coming back under BBC control fully. The BritBox experiment is over.
It no longer exists, BritBox.
As far as I know, because I was on BritBox, and that's how I ended up getting nudged onto ITVX. But I must say, my main reason for ITVX subscription has always been, oh, I need to watch that Doctor Who episode for whatever podcast, and I don't actually own it. So I'll renew my ITVX subscription, and now I won't do that.
Along with spin-offs like Surgery and Adventures, Torchwood, and Class. That might be my inspiration for cancelling my TV licence.
I've only watched the first episode of Class, and I
think I watched two, and that was it.
Went no further.
Blah, blah, blah. The back catalogue and online archive will launch on the 1st of November. At the same time, the BBC will launch an extensive online archive from the show's history, with everything from interviews with cast to written documents, long-unheard audio. So, like, in the same way that Twin Dilemma is a long-unwatched video.
I would say they've sorted out their rights issues, so Disney are going to get it everywhere except the UK, is what my guess would be.
I had seen Anthony Coburn's son on the social media had been saying that the BBC had... He's quite a combative fellow, isn't he? To put it politely.
He thinks his dad invented police boxes, I think.
Yeah, and he was saying that the BBC had contacted him. Obviously, this could all just be absolute rubbish. So he was claiming that the BBC had contacted him to renegotiate the rights for episodes 2 to 4 specifically, wasn't it, of An Unearthly Child, so the Tribe of Gun bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he found their offer derisory and so wasn't going to let that happen. But, I mean, that could be complete bollocks. Yeah, the last time he was making noises like this was around the time of the 50th, I think.
Yeah, so. I remember exactly. It pops up every so often, Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is it just to get some money? Is it just have some money to go away?
If I was trying to negotiate a rights issue with the BBC, I think I'd choose a story other than the one where the only episode anyone's interested in is the first one.
Yeah. Last time I was on, I think I confessed I'd never watched Tribe of Gum. I'd always gone straight onto the Daleks. But in my own podcast, someone picked all of the first 4 episodes as their choice for the bunker. And so I have now watched all of Tribe of Gum. And it's really good.
So, Ian, what has been happening?
I have resumed recording The Bunker, Season 2. So
because we're Bunker Podcast.
Yes. Yeah, so this is you're my third or fourth recording, consecutive recording this week. Yeah, so I've had Rob Shearman, Steve Lyons, and then various people who are sort of cutaway people that you will know, but your listeners may not, like our colourist, Andrew Orton.
All right, yes.
Oh, I know him. Yeah, I know him.
I had a lovely conversation with him about the arts of colouring comics.
Yeah, he's been doing some really nice 3D renderings of the studio setups, hasn't he, for the recordings of the stories?
Yeah. He's a sort of Doctor Who polymath, and, well, many other things as well, audio drama. But we talked about him last time I was on, actually, because it was him that did the brilliant CGI dinosaurs for the for Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which just the fact that he did something so effective in his bedroom just goes to show what could be done if people wanted to, if there was ever a special edition of Invasion of the Dinosaurs. It could be done quite easily, I think, by the people that can do these things. And I've also, I've been to the BFI for the 5 Doctors, where I finally met Peter Davison for real in the green room.
Oh.
Which is particularly great because I've been listening to the early assembly of my audio drama, which stars Peter Davison and Colin Baker and Louise Jameson.
Oh.
So that's been great. my Hungry Moon adaptation, which is like a horror thing. So it's not Doctor Who related, but being me, I've got quite a lot of Doctor Who-y people in. But yeah, so it's sounding brilliant. And we've, you know, and accidentally, you didn't really realize, but it's nearly all the scenes with Peter Davison are with Colin Baker. So we've got lots of, they didn't record together, but yeah, they sound brilliant together. Two actors being brilliant, and Colin's playing a 100-year-old blind man and sounds brilliant. And then Peter is Peter, and he's just, you know, he did his whole performance in 40 minutes over clean feed, and it's just superb. So it was good meeting him and just shaking his hand and just going, yeah, because I listened to the recording. I ended up being in a service station. I got stuck in traffic and things, so I ended up, rather than having to reschedule or not be there, I went into a service station and put my headphones on. And then Peter was saying, yeah, and I was in my cupboard like I was for the most of the pandemic in his recording booth. It was brilliant. I mean, as we'll talk tonight, I've been on a journey with Peter Davison since 1981 as a person who just couldn't get over Tom Baker having left. But we'll talk about that in due course.
What's this audio drama called again?
The Hungry Moon. It's a Ramsay Campbell horror novel. And Ramsay Campbell, if people know him, they'll be like, oh my God, he's my favourite. Stephen King's a fan of his, and he's sort of renowned as the British Stephen King. Sort of does Lovecraftian horror, really dark horror with a sort of when I say sci-fi, I mean like Lovecraft, as in the monsters rather than being supernatural tend to be horrors from beyond the stars kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I picked up the rights before the lockdown, and then lockdown got in the way of everything. Except lots of people were available to be recorded, which was good. And now we're finally almost at the point where we're going to get it for sale.
Yes, I think Ramsay Campbell did one of my favourite books of horror short stories, The Doll Who Ate His Mother. Is that him?
Yeah. I think that's actually his first novel, if I remember rightly. But yeah, that's a horrible book. It's brilliant. But yeah, An unborn baby ends up eating its way out of a mother, as the title suggests. But I was just listening to the Scarred for Life podcast, which I would recommend to your listeners.
Yes, I've been, yeah.
And Jeremy Dyson was on there. And not only that, actually, my Scarred for Life anecdote opens that episode as well, which is cool, about Threads, the nuclear war thing. During that, Jeremy Dyson, who I also love and have also met a couple of times, he then just mentions in passing Ramsay Campbell and saying that one of his stories is possibly the best horror story ever written. I forget the title of it now, but yeah, Ramsay's a great guy. It's been really good getting to know him. And it's weird, like all best people, he's a sort of secret or not so secret Doctor Who fan. So for him, sitting in on like all the recordings with Colin and with Peter and Louise, he's been very excited as well. For it. So yeah, so it's been a long time. It's been like 5 years from me optioning it to now. Wow. But the idea is we'll have it out for Christmas. And CDs for sale in LA at Gallifrey One.
Jamie Anderson is the one I listened to. I remember listening to first on Scarred for Life. That was really good. I said a lot about his dad, actually, wasn't it? I nudged Hayden to do that. And then Andy Nyman. I don't think I've listened to the Jeremy Dyson one yet.
Yeah, I've not heard the Jamie one.
But I seem to remember back in, what was that, 1984, was it, that they... Yeah. They first had an American one on that was supposed to be the big TV drama predicting what a nuclear war would be like.
The day after, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember sitting through that thinking, oh, this isn't much. And then about a week later or several days later, Threads was on. And I was shitting myself, I remember. It was so much more, because I think I've not watched it since, but I see my memory of Threads or the comparison between the two is Threads seemed far more down to earth.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that a US soap opera will be somewhere glamorous, like Dynasty, whereas an UK soap opera will invariably be somewhere tatty, like Coronation Street.
Well, it was literally, I mean, I could talk for hours about Threads because it's one of my favourite things, but I wouldn't recommend people watch it because it really is.
Yeah, harrowing.
It's harrowing, but I watch it every so often, and I always describe it now because it's set in Sheffield. It's written by Barry Hines, you know, of Kes fame. So it's already grim, even without the nuclear war. And then there's a nuclear war, and I always say now when you watch it, it's like peeking into a parallel universe where it happened in 1984, because it feels so real, and you feel that same the famous bit is, "You bastards, why did they do it? They actually did it." And you feel that same anger every time you, I do anyway. Every time I watch it, I just go, I can't believe we came to this. But it's, such a powerful, powerful piece of television. That and I, Claudius, are my two favourite non-Doctor Who things, I think, and Day of the Triffids. And before we move on to stop talking about threads, I'd also say there's a brilliant podcast called Atomic Hobo, which I listen to on Spotify. She's a Scottish woman and she's obsessed with the Cold War. But one of her regular sort of threads, every so often an episode pops up, and these are the ones I've listened to, is she does 4 minutes of threads in honour of the 4 minute warning. So every episode is an hour long and it analyses what happens in those 4 minutes of threads. If you're not fragile mentally, then because honestly, it's one of those things that if you're in a bad state and with the current state of the world, maybe thinking about nuclear war might not be everyone's cup of tea. But yeah, but it's an absolute masterpiece of filmmaking and storytelling and everything. And There But For the Grace of God, or There But the Grace of Ronald Reagan reading all the reports on nuclear winter and getting together with Gorbachev is probably more likely. Because it was the nuclear winter stuff that became the sort of new science, a bit like new climate change science, except it got taken seriously quickly. And so that fed into The Day After in the States and Threads in the UK and a book I've got, The Dead Hand, which Gareth Kavanagh of Cutaway and Warp Warp pressed into me, tells the sort of behind the scenes of how close we came, but also how we came out of it. And a lot of it was to do with scientists working out what would actually happen if we had a nuclear exchange. Previously, they were acting as though they could just blow loads of cities up and it would just be annoying rather than ending civilization.
Personally, I never thought that a nuclear war would ever happen.
We have a launch detection. We have a Soviet launch detection.
Mark, is that you with your connection to NORAD still on? Can you switch off, please?
No.
Thank you. Don't worry, listeners, confidence is high.
On a happier subject, you've also been you've been adapting the opening for Doctor Who and Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, I believe, for Cutaway Comics to do an animation.
Of course, yeah, because last time I was on, I couldn't say that, could I?
No.
Yeah, that's much happier. Obviously, I love everything I do, but I've absolutely loved writing a script and sort of engaging with David Whittaker's opening chapter. So it's basically an animation done by Mel Meaney, who did the Toymaker fan animation that sort of wowed everyone a few months ago.
Yes, I remember.
And that's how Gareth from Warp Warp got hold of him. And then he did the sort of Sutek thing as a trailer for us, which I got Gabriel. I was there going, I'm directing Gabriel Wolf over Zoom. I wish he had a microphone at his house, but he doesn't. We sorted all that out in post. But yeah, but the David Whittaker thing. So the piece is called A Meeting on the Common, the same as the first chapter. And it's, for those who don't know, it's the alternate beginning to the Doctor Who story that Whittaker wrote in 1964 for the first Doctor Who novelisation. And it's a very strange thing.
This is the whole Barnes Common thing.
Yeah, I think it's got some... I mean, the Barnes Common thing, I think I'm right, was kind of the first planned opening of, you know, what became An Unearthly Child before the Junkyard came in, that the TARDIS was going to be in Barnes Common, which is why it's a police box, which makes a bit more sense why the TARDIS would turn into a police box rather than being in a junkyard turning into a police box. And I think I'm right that that's the bit that almost happened in the TV version, but it sort of stayed in the novelization. So we've sort of gone with that, and the Barnes Common setting is brilliant, and it's sort of Ian's monologue, but he's a rocket scientist, weirdly. And then he meets Barbara and doesn't know Barbara. And there's been a hideous car crash and a dead soldier in a lorry.
That's right, yeah.
And it's a really, really fun, dark opening. But it's strange as well, because you read it, and I must have read it 1,000 times, especially when I was younger, because I had that, you know, it's one of the few Doctor Who books I owned that wasn't from the library. But it's only when you analyse it and you have to sort of go through it and make it make sense into a script that you realise it was written at a clip. It needed an editor. lots of it doesn't actually make sense if you actually try to make it into a narrative. And the characters, Barbara especially, isn't in the novel, isn't consistent with what she knows and what she doesn't know. She mentions that Susan's got a grandfather, then mentions that she's met him, then doesn't recognize him. Or it doesn't occur to her that the old man might be the grandfather of that she's already said she's met. So actually, in a weird way, it's a mess, that magical opening episode written by David Whittaker. So I basically had to make decisions to make it make sense as a film, which I'm really pleased with. And the everlasting match, which people who've read it will remember, the Doctor has this amazing invention, which is a match that never goes out. You can tell he's from a highly advanced civilization. So we have fun with that.
It has been like the Diddly Dumb podcast, really, because this only makes sense because of a brilliant editor. So it's.
I must say, last time I didn't realise quite how much editing you do, and it's still really long.
Al Noh, who was one of our first hosts, used to do all the editing, and we were taking a bit an unusually long time one week. It turned out that once he'd finished everything, he'd realised that his audacity at his end hadn't been working. It was so distorted, and yes, it was so distorted it couldn't go on. So he went through the entire recording, redoing his lines at every stage.
What?
It's really only because I'm such an anal obsessive, really. Things really irritate me, like on podcasts where you can hear people, when people pause to take a breath, you can hear them breathing in. That really irritates me. So I go through and delete all those. So.
Well, to be honest, that is what you're supposed to do. And I think standards have fallen severely with what people expect because of podcasts. But when I'm doing The Bunker this season, I am going to, because some of them I did and some of them I didn't, probably inspired by your example, I am going to go through and, you know, take out every and er and most intakes of breath and all that sort of stuff.
The usual thing is that for every 13 minutes we record, we usually end up with 10 minutes of finished podcast. And so I can tell if it's suddenly, in the last 10 minutes, I've deleted 5 minutes of stuff, then I know that, we're just gabbling, going all over the place. If I've only deleted 1 minute out of the last 10 minutes, yeah, I know that we're really, really talking some sense. And I start thinking, bloody hell, this is going to last about 2 hours. No one's going to want to listen to it.
We haven't said what the recording's for.
So Meeting on the Common?
Yes.
Oh, yes. So Meeting on the Common is going to be for... It's for part of the next Warp Warp, which I believe is Warp Warp 6.
Ah.
Which is basically called 1963 because it's all about basically Doctor Who coming into being. And obviously, because it's the 60th. So the idea is it will be out for the 60th. But if it isn't, that's very on brand for Warp Warp. But I sort of said, you know, as I think I said, and Gareth agrees, is I'd rather everyone just got everything right because Warp Warp's on sale for decades. You know, We're still selling Warp Warp 1. Every time we go to a con, the reprinted ones. So it's not tomorrow's fish and chip paper.
No, I keep seeing that people are still proud enough when they buy that first, that compendium edition, that they're still posting pictures of it on social media and stuff. Keeps popping up on my timeline even just a few days ago.
Yeah, and when we're selling, you know, at cons and at the BFI, our comics and everything, the Warps always sell, they always sell fairly equally. They sell, every time we have a stack of Warps, we never bring as many as we could have sold. They're always all gone.
My tribute to the Weetabix cards of Warp Warp is still in its original envelope that it arrived in the post because I can't. I'll lose all the cards if I don't keep it in a secure envelope.
Yeah. Gareth was saying the other day that it's really annoying, but how many of them are for sale on eBay in places? He just loses track and he goes down a rabbit hole every so often getting really angry because people are actually out there selling them and people are paying it for stuff they could go and get at the Warp Warp website.
Yeah.
And they're not even thinking to look. They're just going, oh, that's obviously looks like a collectible thing. And they'll go and buy somebody who bought it probably from the Warp Warp website and they'll go and buy it for 60 quid or whatever. And those people should probably spend a little bit longer on search engines before they purchase things on eBay. Now, Warp Warp's a wonderful thing, and it's good to be sort of part of it through this. Well, it's going to be a brilliant film because it's obviously going to be part of the package of goodies that is on the front. And there are other things that are on it that I'm involved with that I still can't talk about because they haven't announced them yet.
Ooh, even just between us, any idea what the goodies are?
Meeting on the Common is the sort of jewel in the crown of the van, but yeah, we've got...
Spins a web, any size, catches thieves,
just like flies, look out. Oh, so that's good. But I've had dinner with him before, with Toby Haydock, when I was running a little con in Manchester. But yeah, we could probably talk about that soon.
I think we ought to emphasise, listeners, that when Ian was running a little con in Manchester, he means a convention.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I'm not Slippy Jimmy.
If you'd said somewhere like, I don't know, Canterbury or Wiltshire, people might have given you the benefit of the doubt. If you said Manchester, they'll think, con, what exactly does he mean here? Yes, links to the Warp Warp website, of course, listeners, at our show notes at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, where we'll also put a link to Atomic Hobo as well.
Yeah, and Scarred for Life.
And Scarred for Life. Hang on. Has something gone wrong with the time band here? I thought the last Warp Warp only came out last year.
I know. My joke, which Gareth is so good, Gareth has started using it himself, is at this rate, we'll be a monthly by the year 2050. Because we're in a recursive occlusion. It's getting less and less each time. It's the slowest time trap ever.
So what else is going on with Cutaway these days? That you can tell us, of course.
I don't think there's anything secret at the moment. It's everything is out. We've obviously just launched our Inferno Kickstarter, which is Inferno has become a beast. The original plan from Gary Russell, which is amazing. We've got Gary Russell, and the artist is John Ridgway, which is obviously also amazing.
Yeah.
Who we've worked with before. Gary's original plan was a very ambitious 3-volume saga set after the Third Doctor leaves the parallel universe, the parallel Earth. And the main thing is the Doctor got it slightly wrong, but only by 6 weeks. So the Earth is going to crack apart, but in 6 weeks is the sort of premise of that. And Gary has this saga that involves also, what's the name of the character from Mind of Evil, the Chinese woman?
Chun-Li.
Yeah, Chun-Li. So Chun-Li is a character, because obviously that's a Don Horton character as well. So the idea is the people who are in the Mind of Evil, their parallel universe selves, are also on the world that the Inferno events are happening.
All right.
So you're going to have UK and then out into Europe and America and then China as well. So they're going to have this great big saga as all the different, you know, the world starts basically falling apart with Primords roaming the chaos and volcanoes cracking open continents. But before that, he decided to, he suddenly went, well, actually, what we also need is an alternate history of how the world we see in Inferno came about before the volcano and Project, what's it called? The Project in Inferno. Is it just called Project Inferno?
I'm not sure the civil servants could reasonably claim to think, no, you're talking nonsense, Doctor. If they've already named it Project Inferno.
I mean, it's called Project Inferno.
Oh, so this is why I've been seeing all these Unity with Strength poster things.
Haven't all just... Elon Musk's Twitter hasn't just finally worked his magic on us all.
I do hope that in the parallel universe Inferno with the Mind of Evil characters that Barnum survives.
Oh, I don't know. You'll have to ask Gary Russell about that. So this first Kickstarter is a prologue, and it starts in 1940 with the assassination of Winston Churchill. And that's not really a spoiler because that's sort of in the Kickstarter. And then the rise of Oswald Mosley. And it sort of takes it from there. Like the first few pages are all the deaths of just about everyone famous apart from Adolf Hitler and Mussolini. And then that takes us from 1940 up to the sort of day before the Doctor arrives, is the idea. And then the idea is you have the events of Inferno, and then the 3-book saga will continue after that.
I rather thought the Unity with Strength poster was some kind of advert for this conference in Manchester last week.
Yeah. I love that Martin Geraghty poster that he did for us, Unity of Strength. That's the sort of main thing that's going on with Cutaway. But then we've also just finally published My Sutec, which is published with sort of Omega, one-shot. So Gods and Monsters, he's finally hit the shelves. And also Steve Gallagher's absolutely brilliant Farrell's one-shot, which is also part of the Gods and Monsters. So the character in that, Faustine, Princess of Farrell, to give her a full title, is a character I'm also currently writing for the sort of going forward into the Gods and Monsters saga.
If you go into your newsagent, you can't find a copy of that Farrell's comic. Have a look behind some of the newspapers, because I've heard sometimes it gets trapped behind the mirror.
Oh, God.
Right. I'm going to be like, what's his name in Robin Dem? Going now. I don't have to sit and put up with this.
Oh, no, Doc, it's happening again.
You won't find them in the newsagents, but you might find them in your local comic shop if they order from Diamond. Also, you can get them off the Cutaway website. And if you order from Cutaway, you get the amazing value-added material discs, which, in the case of the Tharyl, includes lots of Warriors Gate material. I hosted Steve, Graham Harper, Matthew Waterhouse, and then we had Paul Joyce and Justin from the BFI.
And I understand the Hinchcliffe book has now been announced.
Yes, it has. So it's a series of essays, which is edited by Gary Russell, and also a really big in-depth interview with Philip as well. And it's also going to be an absolutely sumptuous book, as you'd expect from the people behind Vault Warp and Cutaway. So that's going to be lovely. And I've written one of the essays. But yeah, that's something to look out for. And there will be a Kickstarter for that as well. So keep watching your socials, as they say.
So, and as with everything we've talked about, of course, listeners, links in the show notes on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. I think that's, I hope nothing else has been happening, because otherwise we'll never have any time to get the Casanova thing in. You up to anything, Mark?
No.
Good for that.
Move on.
Right, well, listeners, as I'm sure you won't have guessed in the slightest from the introduction to this podcast, we are taking a look at Fifth Doctor story, Castrovalva, directed by Fiona Cumings, written by, that was a slog, reading up on Christopher H. Bidmead. Directed by Fiona Cumings, written by Christopher H. Bidmead himself. Broadcast in January 1982, music by Paddy Kingsland. Supposed to have replaced a master story called Project Zeta Plus, although I've never seen any more than that. Originally called The Visitor, and it's obviously the first story following the regeneration from Tom Baker into Peter Davison. Now, Ian, I've heard on the grapevine that your big secret is that you've spent a lifetime on a journey with Peter Davison, haven't you?
Yeah, not in a Willy Fogg kind of sense, but in a... just in terms that I hated the idea of anybody other than Tom Baker being the Doctor, because...
Me too, yeah.
I was born in 1972. I don't remember John Pertwee. I was basically, you know, like I think yourself, I was that generation that Tom Baker sticking around too long for almost sank the show, is one of the arguments.
Mm.
Amazing as he was, what we might call the Tennant effect, it became too much the show. And as a result, I suggested this for this podcast because I happened to watch episode one of Castrovalva. I thought, I'll give it a go. And I've literally never watched it since transmission because I remember hating it. There's so much Doctor Who to watch. You know, I've had the DVD for years, just as a sort of job lot of stuff, and I've still never put it in the machine.
Was that with the New Beginnings box set?
Oh, I can't remember. I think it was all separate by the time I got a whole bunch for free off somebody.
So you're watching it to prepare for this podcast. It's the first time you've seen it since the original broadcast.
Yeah, well, I watched episode one, and I think that made me go, I'm actually enjoying this. And that made me go, well, you know, I quite like being forced to sort of watch stuff that I might not get around to. That's half the fun of these podcasts. Mm. I'm doing so many podcasts of my own. And I'm guesting on yours and a few others. And yeah, and it's great to sort of go, you know, just see how wrong you were when you were, what was it, 1981? So I was, God, I was like nine and already jaded by Doctor Who, and yet somehow still a lifelong fan. Just mad when you think about it. But when you look into it, you go, A, they changed the Doctor. And then they stuck it on Mondays and, what was it, Mondays and Wednesdays?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and that first episode was on what we now know as a Blue Monday, the 4th of January, you know, when more suicides happen than any other day of the year.
You're the most jovial guest we've ever had on here.
I know. I don't know what's going on. But yeah, you just go, God, it's like, we've just had Christmas. It's the depths of winter. A Monday night at the fag end of Christmas and it's the new year. And they're putting a new doctor on and it's Castrovalva. No wonder my 9-year-old self absolutely just wasn't into it. I hated it. I remember being quite depressed. And I probably, because, you know, usually when you watch old Doctor Who, you kind of go, oh, yeah, I remember watching this bit. I don't really remember much when I was watching the other episodes. I think I might not have watched them. I always say the first time I willfully didn't watch Doctor Who was during Colin Baker, but now I'm wondering if actually I just couldn't be asked whether I missed it or not, because I know I had to go to Cubs and stuff. And eventually I dropped out of Cubs because I was back into Doctor Who. And so I chose Doctor Who over Cubs, which is a story of my life, I think. Choosing wholesome group activities and deciding to do Doctor Who instead. So I think maybe I've just watched Castrovalva, 3 episodes of it at least, probably for the first time. But that first episode is absolutely brilliant. Peter Davison is, as we know, an amazing doctor. And as the years go by, even without me watching Castrovalva, he's just been rising through the ranks, you know, as I'm shaking off my sort of prejudice against him. And Tom Baker I still love, but Tom Baker's been dropping a bit. Like, maybe I'm just taking him for granted, or Peter Davison is actually a very, you know, as we know, he's a very fine actor and a brilliant doctor. And some of his stories are absolutely fantastic. I think because some of them aren't very good, aren't the best, then maybe that sort of taints his overall run to some people. Your last guest you had on, Dave Kitchen, I think Dave-O, as I always call him now after listening to the Doctor Who show, Dave-O. Is his favourite Doctor, I think. Is that not correct? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much so.
I think there's a cut-off point, which is possibly maybe halfway through Key to Time, where before that time it's much easier to love Tom unconditionally, and after which it's a lot harder. Mm-hmm. Then it's so much heavier, so much more melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's all summed up by the costume he's wearing, those enormous pirate boots and that heavy, heavy burgundy coat that he actually looks as if he's being as weighed down as the show seems to be.
Mm.
He looks tired as well, don't they? The years seem to be telling on his face.
Yeah.
His hair's lost its shape. It's lost its luster at one point as well, hasn't it, famously? Like he is shagged out.
In reading up on this, in preparation for this, I saw in the an interview with Stephen Moffat, which admittedly is probably about at least 40 years ago, and he really trashes Tom. Tom Baker had long since disappeared up his own arse in a 7-year-long act of self-destruction that took him from being a dangerous young actor with a future to a sad, mad old ham, safely locked away in a voiceover booth, which I thought sounded dangerously close to an 18-year-old fan appearing on Open Air with Patty Caldwell and trying to make an impression. Now, personally, reacting like that to just his episodes is ridiculous, but you can quite understand it when you also take into account how you were hearing that he was behaving on set, you know, to the crew and to other people, and you think, however much you might adore Tom, you think, that's just not acceptable. And so you can understand why they want to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no secret he was a difficult bastard. And one of the things in, because I've been sort of doing this deep dive into Warrior's Gate with all the commentaries. So, I heard from Paul Joyce that Paul Joyce had been told, oh, Tom likes to give notes and it can be a nightmare. So Paul apparently, in the sort of first rehearsal, put a tape recorder down and pressed record. And Tom was like, what's that for? This is Paul Joyce saying this. And apparently, well, he said, well, that's because I hear you like to give notes, so we don't want to miss any. So we record the session. And apparently Tom didn't make a peep, just got on with the rehearsal. And also, you know, sort of speaking to Matthew Waterhouse, I don't think there's any secret of that Tom wasn't very nice to Adric.
No.
As he came in.
It sounds a bit like when, was it Terence Dix was up in the gallery at TV, at Television Centre, and Tom Baker was saying that this script is absolute epic. I mean, Terence Dix is a very nice man, but he can't write for Toffee. And then the sort of click goes on, and the loudspeaker across the studio says, "Oh, thank you very much, Tom. That's a very kind thing to say."
Yeah, but Matthew Waterhouse, I'd heard the story, so I asked him, because the story was he had a Doctor Who poster on his wall, and then he went to work.
Yes,
in Doctor Who, and when he came back after the first day, he took down the poster, and I sort of said, "Is that true?" And he said, "Yeah, that's true." But he said, "I didn't have a poster of Tom Baker on my wall. It was a poster of the Doctor. It was not Tom Baker." So, even though it was Tom Baker as Doctor Who. No, he's a lovely man, absolutely gorgeous man, Matthew Waterhouse. I had a really good chat with him at Hooverville, and we might be working with him on some projects, which I can't talk about.
It's terribly sad, actually, reading his book, The Box Boy, but when he turns up as this... thinking Tom Baker's his hero on the first day, and he sees how Tom and Lala are behaving towards each other, and it just seems that his illusions are shattered almost at once, and it explains a lot, really. Especially when you hear sometimes Lala going on about how immature Matthew was to work with, you think, well, you imagine at 18, he would expect to have his two main co-stars as some... examples of how adult actors are supposed to behave. And when you see them behaving like children.
Yeah, there's a horrible bit in one of the Doctor Who magazines, and it's just got a great big pull-out quote saying Adric was a disappointment. And it's a pull-out quote, and then it's a great big thing from Bidmead saying how bad he was, and he's at least got some sort of awareness that, I don't envy him because he was 18 and a really inexperienced actor. And and they make slightly smutty allusions as to why J&T might have wanted him there and then wanted a young thing to come bouncing in for reasons I couldn't possibly understand, I think the quote is. But then it's just almost a picture of, and then this poor lad, in a way that just hopefully wouldn't happen now, was just abandoned. Yeah. There was no support or anything. He was a really inexperienced actor, and the producer and whoever else didn't do anything to help him. And then he got bullied by his heroes.
Hadn't his elder brother just died?
I don't know about that, but Matthew is so nice. Such a lovely man.
I mean, it always seems awkward, even watching the extras on the Blu-ray, on the DVD for this. Matthew always looks as if, when they're wandering around this estate where they filmed it all, Matthew always seems a bit awkward, doesn't he? If he doesn't feel entirely comfortable.
I always think he has second thoughts about doing any of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then he does it every few years, a bit like Davison used to do as well. Like, he'd sort of do it, go, "I'm never doing this again," and then it would wear off, and someone would offer him a bag of cash, and he'd go, "Oh, do it again." Now him and Matthew are a lot more at peace with it, I think.
What, with each other?
Well, I think everyone's at peace with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think if anyone with any sort of self-awareness is probably slightly ashamed of how they treated an 18-year-old as well.
Yeah.
But that's more the sort of Tom thing. But but I just think they're all just older and wiser, and Doctor Who's this really strange thing you can't do anything about now, so you might as well embrace it.
Having seen him at one or two Capitol events, I think we've noticed that he seems to have developed for himself a sort of spiky, personality, but sort of when he's on stage, which actually works quite well. It doesn't come across as bitchy. Though. Yeah, but he will make digs at, for instance, at something that Janet had done, rather than just sitting there and saying, "Oh, wow, okay."
Oh, do you mean Peter?
No, Matthew.
Oh, Matthew.
I think it comes across really well.
Yeah.
Also, Matthew's taken to kind of really overselling himself as well, hasn't he? And comedically overstating the importance of Adric in a lot of stories.
Yeah.
For comic effect, which works well as well, which diffuses a lot of the jibes at him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of it's just because the structuring and some of these writers the team wasn't on top of their game. They had so many companions, so many moving parts, which they maybe could have avoided by not having half of them. And then, so like you alluded to in your fantastically written sketch at the beginning, was Nyssa having to go to sleep for a whole episode, and because it's almost like they were just there going, oh, for God's sake, I've written this for two companions, or one of them's going to have to go to sleep then. Just that sort of, I don't know, quite shabby level of TV sometimes. Mm. But in Castrovalva, I think they do have the thing where Adric's basically chained up for the entire thing. But as I understand it, JNT did go, well, we need him to do something. So JNT had the idea of him being the projection at the beginning. So there was a sort of hologram or projection Adric, just to give Adric a little bit more to do in the way of lines. But even then, he's not very well served as a character at all. He's just sort of hanging around.
Literally.
Yeah, he's literally hanging around, hardly anything to do. His maths is really important to the plot. The fact he's a mathematical genius of a mathematical excellence badge. But it really is like, you know, if you're an actor, you must have just been sat there going, great, they just don't know what to do with me. I'm probably out the door soon, aren't I? As he was. Because I remember thinking at the time, there's too many people in the TARDIS.
Yes.
And it didn't help that they seemed to always have the most dreary conversations around that console in that era as well. They weren't very well written most of the time, those conversations.
Well, it wouldn't really have mattered, would it? Because they had three people unnecessarily at the start of Tom's run, didn't they? But because there was a chemistry between them,
mm-hmm.
you didn't really care that Harry might have been just standing around saying nothing for 10 minutes. But there was zero chemistry between the four of them.
Yeah, yeah.
As characters, I don't know, I'm sure a few of them got on quite well.
Yeah, well, I think I remember seeing a thing with Fielding and Sutton saying they worked out that their characters hadn't spoken directly to one another for about five adventures in a row. Because, I mean, some of the level of writing was quite in that era. And I think the episode we're discussing here, Castrovalva, I think, which is just some interesting stuff going on, I think there's also some... This is the one that they apparently went over with a fine-tooth comb to make sure it hit the ground running, and this one, of all things, had to be the best it could be. And I'm there going, really? Because to me, it seems like it was tossed off.
Charming.
It should be so lucky.
It's very much... We're looking at... I suppose I've really worked on this script because I've done two drafts instead of one. Much as I really liked the first episode when we talked about it, now I've watched the other three, I must say I'm not a massive fan of Castrovalva.
Oh.
How do you guys feel? Now we're sat here. My fault we're talking about it.
Well, I'd love this flavour of Doctor Who. And I know it's not to everyone's taste, the Bidmead era, but I would have been 10 when this came out. And it would have come out just immediately after the Five Faces of Doctor Who season of repeats. Am I right?
I do believe so, yes.
Well, this was in January 82, so...
And so I was absolutely... By the time we got round to actually seeing the first episode of Peter Davison's era, despite my love of Tom, I was absolutely pumped for it, because I think they repeated Legopolis beforehand as well, didn't they? So we'd had that as for the running.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about this... I don't know. I think it's because I grew up... Because I was that age when this was on, I just kind of accepted it that this is kind of how Doctor Who felt now. And again, I mentioned on the last podcast about my kind of Pavlovian response to some of the music cues. And I get the same thing again with this whole era, really. And especially with Paddy Kingsland's music. I mean, Paddy Kingsland is just fantastic. I loved his work on The Changes.
Of course, yes.
Which me and Doc are big fans of. And obviously, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well. And again, it just takes you back to that era. I think we've moved in 1979 from Wales into Wiltshire. And it's just an era that I still remain very fond of to this day. I think 17, 18 and 19 are my three peak seasons as a fan. And then I started to drop off afterwards. But I couldn't wait for Castrovalva to start. I remember, I think there was... all the build-ups with, you know, you get the Doctor Who magazines with all the photos of Peter Davison on the front in his cricket gear, standing outside the TARDIS and stuff. And it was just a really exciting time. And I still get a little bit of that buzz when I'm watching this story. So for me, I just found the whole thing really exciting from start to finish, to be honest. It dipped a little bit around episode 3. I think it's got that typical thing that Doctor Who stories have where episode 3 is kind of like a holding position, really.
Mm.
But I thought it was great and I thought it was fascinating as well. I loved all the recursion stuff, and especially when they're running around and like it's an Escher painting. I just find it somewhat spellbinding, to be honest. And I think the companions are fairly well served as well. Matthew Waterhouse, who's obviously, you know, you alluded to him getting a lot of stick from, you know, other actors and not being supported by the cast. But I've also felt like for a long time that character of Adric is kind of bullied by fandom in a way. He's quite often people's whipping boy for, yes, you know, just poking fun at the whole time, which always really upsets me because when I was that age, as I've said on here before, I really related to the character of Adric. I wanted to be Adric. And I probably was, you know, having just moved schools, I was a bit of a misfit. I was sort of new to my school. I hadn't quite settled in. So sometimes I would be the boy who'd be pointed at and, you know, I'd be the whipping boy, so to speak. And
is that because you were wearing a big badge?
A big badge, yeah. And so I feel really defensive of the character of Adric because he really did mean a lot to me. I mean, there's one of the people on Twitter, part of their shtick, you know, it's just their thing, is that they constantly, pretty much on a daily basis, make fun of Adric. And I really like them. They do a lot of funny stuff, but I've found myself getting really, it just drags me down seeing a character that I really like just being, and that I, you know, like I say, meant a lot to me as a kid, to see that character being dragged down the whole time.
I really liked Adric as well. I didn't really like Castrovalva at the time, but I'd already come to like Adric from the previous season. And once I'd settled in to watching Doctor Who and was begrudgingly accepting that it wasn't Tom anymore, I was enjoying it. And then when Earthshock happened, I was totally pumped and absolutely, you know, loved it. But also, in a weird way, loved that they killed Adric in a way that I appreciated the shock of it. Because yes. I think I'm right that it came after Blake Seven had done their big ending, hadn't it?
Yes, it did.
So maybe it's the writer brain in me. I loved it when they killed people that you liked. And I knew that me being upset was also a really good thing for a storyteller to evoke. So I loved it when goodies got killed.
Well, famously, on here, I had a similar reaction to it, Ian, and, which caused me to perform a similar death to one of my favourite toys, my Planet of the Apes Galon doll, so.
Yeah, so I had a lot of time for Adric. I did like lots of things in Castrovalva this time round, so don't get me wrong on that. Generally, I didn't like it loads, though, to be honest. But Doc, what about you?
Well, I had the same thought. I mean, one, I was thinking, oh, there can't be anyone who replaced Tom. Two, I was thinking, oh, Lord, it's the guy off All Creatures Great and Small. So it's not like, I mean, if anyone had known any of the previous Doctors, it might have been your parents, but no, William Hartnell, isn't he that guy who's always playing villains? And then Patrick Charlton, oh, he's that character actor, isn't he? John Pertwee, oh, is he the guy who's on the Navy Lark? But even kids would have known who Tristan was.
Yeah, yeah. That was one of the things we watched. We watched every episode of All Creatures Great and Small. Absolutely loved it. We all cried when they went off to war. It was a brilliant show.
Although I'm not sure we're crying now that the new Tristan is an absolute And I will confess I'm not that keen on post-regen stories per se, as so much of them tends to get taken up by this need to have the Doctor messing around with some post-regeneration trauma. I'm not sure they've ever, before or since, got to such extremes as introducing the new Doctor by having him carried around in a coffin for half the story.
Yeah.
I do Nyssa and Tegan look anything but silly carrying that coffin around over and over.
That was one of the first bits that sort of lost me, was episode two. I liked episode one because, A, it just meant, God, he's a good actor, is Peter Davison. And then obviously there's what we'd call Easter eggs now, all the millions of little references to previous incarnations, which is all brilliant. And the Zero Room's actually quite a good idea. It's where Bidmead's sort of big idea, mathsy stuff, if he doesn't go too far with it, it can create some quite good ideas. And then in episode two, where they have that wheelchair and they're dragging it around, and it's just like, to me, it's very amateur hour. And they have that whole bit where the wheelchair falls in the river, and they go to all the effort of like getting it out of the river, and then they don't use it. And then they go on to Castrovalva, and you're just there going, Jesus Christ, this was the script they apparently worked on. So that it was, that felt particularly lots of padding with poor companions.
Yeah.
On an outside broadcast, doing all this stuff, they could maybe have had a better script. and got to Castrovalva a bit earlier and done something a bit more interesting.
I mean, famously, Castrovalva was filmed fourth, wasn't it, in the series, with this idea that, I mean, there's actually a really, on the Blu-ray collection box set for this season on the bonus disc, there's a very good interview with Matthew Sweet with Peter Davison. And he talks a lot about, you know, Tom turns up and effectively spends 7 years playing Tom, whereas Peter is essentially a character actor, and he expects to have to play a character. And so there's supposed to be a lot of discussion between Bidmead and JNT about, oh, how will we give him a character right from the start? Well, let's give him three stories in order to develop a character. And so by the time he films the fourth one, he'll have a fully fledged personality, which we can stick right at the beginning of the series so that people will be impressed post-Tom. Although I have read other people suggesting that what actually happened is that two of the planned scripts fell through, so that when Peter started, the reason he started with Four to Doomsday is that that was the only script that was ready at the time, and that they couldn't have actually recorded Castrovalva first because the script wasn't available. I'm not sure that's true enough, but it wouldn't be a surprise, would it, to hear producers or directors changing the historical record to make it look as if, oh no, we did that deliberately, you know, it wasn't anything to do with chaos. And I mean, I've learned so much in reading up in preparation for this by reading some of the interviews with Bidmead, because it's so bizarre. He says at one point, I thought about Castrovalva and the Zero cabinets, I thought putting him in a box would be a brilliant way of introducing the Doctor as a slow reveal. And I thought, no, surely a slow reveal is that you slowly reveal what his character's going to be, not that you occasionally show him by sliding open the top bit of a box. It seems utterly bizarre that, yes, it wouldn't be unusual to have maybe the first 1.5 or 2 episodes of a story being an immediately post-regenerated Doctor being a bit out of it and being sort of leaning on the shoulder of his companion until he recovers. But what do you mean in a box? It just seems it seems rather bizarre. And then there's the issue of the whole of the first episode is stuck in the TARDIS.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, when you look at it, actually, I wonder if the starting point for the coffin that they carry around is also so the Master can think the Doctor's in there at the end and the Doctor isn't in there. I suspect that might be where everything came from. If he thinks the Doctor's in there and then he isn't in there, then that'll be good. And he's not, he's hiding behind a tapestry. It's a strange old 4 episodes, though, it must be said.
Oh, I really enjoyed that first episode. I don't mind the wandering around with the...
Yeah.
With the Zero cabinet. I find it quite entertaining. It really reminds me of a kind of mix between sort of Robin of Sherwood and Blake 7, that first episode. The location stuff, anyway. Sorry, that's the second episode, isn't it? Especially the Castrovalvan's hunting gear as well. Looks like it's straight out of a Blake 7 story.
Is it called Star Drive, where they have all those punks riding around on bikes?
That's exactly the episode that I'm thinking of.
And they've got those sort of helmets, haven't they?
Yeah. I loved all the stuff in the first episode as well, wandering around the TARDIS, and I think they do a really good job of using very small bits of set to give the impression that the TARDIS is huge. And doesn't seem to get boring to me.
It's a bit like I said in the last podcast, where the director of Ark in Space has only got those, you know, that slight curve of an outside corridor and then a particular line into the life support chamber. But by using that in various angles, they make something look far more than it was.
Directed by Rodney Bennett.
Rodney Bennett, that was it. Well done. So yes, it was an unusual start. I think his impressions of Bill and Pat are a little...
Broad?
Broad, let's put it that way. And then he mentions Vicky and Joe and K-9, doesn't he? As a story, it doesn't really do much for me. I think it was...
I think its ideas are better than its execution.
Oh, maybe.
I think I find Bidmead... I do find him a bit... I don't know him, I've never met him, but the combination of his ideas and interviews I've seen, he seems a little bit pompous, a little bit pleased with himself.
Yes, very much, yeah.
I think it was Bidmead said about Joyce that he sat there behind a copy of The Guardian saying lines every so often. But the whole Warriors Gate thing just made me go, I think Bidmead didn't show Paul Joyce an actual script, which is why this whole tension between, you know, the fact that Steve Gallagher wrote four drafts of it, which we've actually seen, but all Paul Joyce was told was, we've written this outline and it needs work. But actually, Bidmead was, Joyce is behind his Guardian saying a few things, and Joyce is working on a script that, you know, is four drafts in, and lots of it ends up on the screen. But in terms of Bidmead, what's weird as well is I do like all the recursive occlusion time trap stuff. I don't quite get why somebody who's obviously, you know, got his A-level science, he's got his badge of scientific excellence, as much as Bidmead, should get the Big Bang so very, very wrong. The whole event one.
What, in the sense that I think it's the galaxy, not the universe, or in the sense that it's not hydrogen?
Yeah, it's like, why is he going on about the galaxy? It bothered me so much. Why does he just say the universe?
Well, everyone did that in science fiction in this era, didn't they? They'd say solar system when they meant the... In something like Dalek Master Plan, you get the impression that whoever's writing it didn't just totally know the difference between a universe, a galaxy, and a solar system.
I know.
Well, just nip quickly over to the next-door galaxy, and... No, galaxies aren't just next door to each other.
Yeah. I think that's why there's things like the Daleks are 12 galaxies away in some versions, aren't they?
Yes, yeah.
People are going, well, that means they're very distant. I'm like, no, I think it means people in the early 60s didn't know and didn't care and just wrote 12 galaxies because it sounded cool. But I did like the recursive occlusion time trap, and the fact it's actually quite radical that the Masters invented these people and they're not real people, but they kill him in the end. Well, obviously, they don't kill him, but defeat him in the end. That's a really cool idea. You know, very Matrix, very philosophically toothy. You know, and it is good. The Escher elements are brilliant as well. The whole thing is, Castrovalva is an Escher painting, isn't it? I believe.
Yes.
So there's lots going on. I've never read the novelization, but I wonder if, as with a lot of Doctor Who, the novelization might be an improvement on the TV version. Fun as the TV version is. Michael Sheard's brilliant, isn't he? Running around. But right at the end, I don't quite know if they knew exactly what would happen to these imaginary people if they did escape with them. And I was watching it going, oh, I wonder what they're going to do. Are they going to, like, disappear and it be all tragic in a new Who kind of way? But in the end, for some reason, Michael Sheard decides to go back in and attack the Master, and then everything just disappears. So it's interesting, Castrovalva, but I'd be very surprised if it was anybody's number one.
Did you watch this with your boy at all?
No. I mean, he's still very reluctant to watch Classic Who.
Okay.
And I know for a fact he wouldn't have stood for this one for more than a few seconds. It's got no monsters in it.
No, because, I mean, pacing of even fastest action classic serials is still comparatively slow for a lot of young viewers, isn't it, these days?
Yeah. I imagine this must have been a bit like people's reaction to Moffat after RTD in the, oh,
yes,
Doctor Who's not for its core audience anymore because it's for slightly older people. There's not a lot for a five-year-old to enjoy in Castrovalva.
No. I wonder if this is kind of why I liked it so much as a 10-year-old, because it's got that feeling of cleverness. So if you're watching it and you feel like you're part of it, you feel like you must be clever, like the television show isn't talking down to you.
Yeah, I think I was the sort of kid that, I know what you mean, but I was really pleased when Doctor Who started being really violent again. I loved Eric Saywood's. When it really hit for me was when I watched Resurrection of Daleks, and I was like, I'm scared of Daleks, and I'm like, whatever age I was then, far too old to be scared of Daleks. I was like, oh my, this is thrilling, and everyone's dying, oh, it's brilliant. And there's a blob being chased around, and it turns out to be a cat, and then he gets eaten and litten and all these things. So I love that era, that dark, violent era of Doctor Who. And I imagine that's probably more fun for five-year-olds as well, because it was action-packed. So cerebral Doctor Who is possibly not my happy place. Not too much of it, anyway. So it's a funny one to talk about, Castrovalva, isn't it?
Hmm.
You guys have done a poll of the Fifth Doctor, haven't you?
Yeah, let's have a look.
I love your polls. I was just thinking, because I wonder where Castrovalva scored. We should have a guess.
I think it's top 10.
Do you think? Castrovalva?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, how many stories are we doing out of Doc? How many are there?
20.
So out of... Oh, so maybe... God, did he only do 20 TV stories?
Yeah.
God, he did, didn't he? So maybe top 10 just because of that then. Because there's some real stinkers that people traditionally hate, like Time Flight and Fort of Doomsday and other ones I haven't seen since Transmission.
Well, Time Flight and Arc of Infinity got nul point.
I quite like Arc of Infinity in some ways. I don't love it, a bit like Castrovalva, but the way people hate that programme.
10th place was Visitation. 9th was Mordrin. 8th was Frontios. 7th was Castrovalva.
7th?
Mm.
Snake Dance, Five Doctors, Enlightenment.
Was Androzani top?
Earthshock, Kinder, Androzani, yeah. Yeah, I thought that was funny what you were saying, Mark, about it. So it felt clever, even if you didn't understand it, because on the commentary, DVD commentary, Tegan's standing over the TARDIS console reading the index file, and she's reading... It's like, on zeroing the coordinate differential, automatic systems reactivate the real-world interface. And Chris Midmead is saying, oh, you know, it's so lovely to get adult words in, isn't it? And he's not being facetious or anything either. No, they're not adult just because they're complicated.
Yeah. Well, there's that interesting thing in the Doctor Who magazine from 92, I think it might be, where he's sort of... quite pompously saying, well, I like Dr. Saddams and everything, but I think we just agree to differ on I don't like his Doctor Who and his emphasis on silliness, whereas he considers his Doctor Who far superior to all that silliness. If his era was much more successful than it is, I think he'd have some room to talk.
Well, let's get on to him, Christopher H. Bidmead, because...
You don't want all that reading to be for naught.
No, Reading up on some interviews he's given really opened my eyes on him. Because I quite liked him. You know, when he said early on in the revived Doctor Who, he did an interview for DWM where he referred to Russell T. Davies as a pretty good first draft writer. Mm. And I quite enjoyed that. Not because I thought it was accurate or anything, but I thought, you know, there are so many people sucking up to him.
Mm.
Every time you open the paper, Joanna Lumley will be dropping a hint that, oh, I love the new Doctor Who. Yes, I'd love to appear in it. Things like that. He's very much those of you who are old enough to remember the Tachyon TV podcast listeners will know that Christopher H. Bidmead has long been derided for crowbying science into Doctor Who. Do two of you remember the song?
Yes.
I don't remember now.
Christopher Bidmead's writing, bringing in science. Christopher Bidmead's writing, adding the logic. Christopher Bidmead's writing, making it boring. Making it boring!
I think that is slightly my reaction to his era.
Maybe fans deride him for this because his stories lack a bit of va-va-voom. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the reason his stories lack a bit of va-va-voom is because he's so insistent in bringing in the science. I know he had nothing to do with Ghostlight, but you shouldn't have to have a Doctor Who story explained to you afterwards. There's a bit, something of Emperor's New Clothes about it.
Mm-hmm.
The way I look at it is Doctor Who is supposed to be for all generations,
mm-hmm.
but now Bidmead's writing it primarily for university students, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel in a way, going into the Bidmead era, it's a bit like when one of your favourite bands, and they've always been like, yeah, we're guitar, bass, drums, vocals and stuff. There's no overdubs on the album and all this sort of thing. And then suddenly they go like, this is our first album with synthesisers on.
Yeah, you just made me think of Radiohead. I absolutely loved their run of albums. And then they did this weird bleepy thing, which was just and I've never put it on again. It's probably an act of genius. But to me, it just seemed like a bleepy thing with no tunes.
Kid A. And
Kid A, I was going to say, yeah. I think it's probably Kid A. And it was like, oh, this is self-indulgent bollocks. I might be entirely wrong, but it's probably a work of towering genius. But compared to the Benz and OK Computer and the first album, it was like, oh, cheers, guys.
Yeah, but I do think that's probably quite an apposite analogy, actually. It is kind of like going from the OK Computer of the Tom Baker era into the Kid A of the Bidmead J&T era.
Yeah, and similarly, I'm sure Kid A is actually musically very, very good because he's Radiohead of a great band, aren't they? And Bidmead's era isn't terrible. It's just maybe not as big and broad and fun and full of adventures, and it's for all the family. And Bidmead's is like, oh, this is good for nerdy students that still like Doctor Who.
Yes.
I mean, the consistent point he's constantly making, isn't it, is that he arrived and it had started off being, which apparently Barry Letts was telling him this, to start off in 63 as a very science-based show, intending to educate children on science. I don't think it's entirely true. May have been one of the original ideas for the series. It never really happened, did it?
Well, no, it was derailed from the beginning.
And in the last few years, with Tom, it's become just very, very silly. Which is true in a way, partly because of Tom's performance, but then the pendulum swings too far in the other direction when Bidmead arrives.
Well, yeah, I was about to say it's an overcorrection. Because I do agree. I mean, much as I can watch Horns of Nymon endlessly because it's funny, I'm still slightly depressed by it. And
hold me back.
It's better when we're just slightly west of Horns of Nymon and silliness. But then we go, I don't know why I'm using west and east, but then we go really, really past with the Bidmead era. And it's like, oh, it's a very serious show. It's more serious than Star Trek. What the F is going on?
Get the soap, Mark, so Ian can wash his mouth out. Just like your Horns of Nymon.
I do like Horns of Nymon.
My problem is that they barely take the trouble to explain these scientific ideas. Entropy. I had no idea what that was at the time. Recursion. No. You've got things like this where it's what I call silo thinking. Where I work, the job's becoming very much like people are working in silos, and that it encourages silo thinking. You constantly concentrate on your own work. So you'll receive an email from someone in a different section of the job who will say, start talking about something, and they're clearly writing it on the assumption that everyone knows the subject they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than thinking, oh, actually, I won't write it like this because these people might not understand it. And I think it can get like that. Yeah, recursion and entry, that'd be interesting, but I had no idea really what they meant at that time.
Yeah, Bidmead comes across like that in interviews. He comes across as someone who's clever, but lacks that, and it can be maybe edges into arrogance in that he doesn't feel the need or doesn't even occur to him that maybe he needs to explain things to people. How many Bidmeads are there?
I thought you were going to do a joke. How many Bidmeads does it take to change a light bulb?
Yeah, how many Bidmeads does it take to change a light bulb? More than is necessary, and it's not very entertaining.
He's only there for a year, isn't he? I think he starts with Castrovalva. He wrote Legopolis. That's confusing me. Where did he start? Right, he started with Leisure Hive and ended with Legopolis, but he returned to write Castrovalva. So really, the difference we'd be looking for him to make a difference between is season 17 and season 18. So 17 is what? Destiny, City of Death, Creature from the Pit, Nightmare of Eden, Horns of Nymon, Sharda.
Hit after hit.
Right, well, to be fair, apart from the genius of Horns of Nymon, there's lots of quite a bit of crap in there, apart from City of Death. And it is arguable, as genius as City of Death is, Tom's being allowed to be completely silly. Mm-hmm. But then this is what I think turned me off Doctor Who. From Leisure Hive onwards, it might be clever, but it's so... I really enjoy Full Circle. I like Keeper of Traken. But the rest of it is so dull and boring and melancholy for me. Right down to Legopolis, which... you see, I think the problem is that... I think this sums up Christopher Bidmead's era. Is that, yes, it may have been silly to an extent before he arrived. But when you think of those, you've got... Leisure Hive, Meglos, Full Circle, State of Decay, Warrior's Gate, Keeper of Traken, and Legopolis. How many moments of humour can you actually remember in any of that? taking his time just to hammer out all the joy. Christopher bid me writing.
I remember not enjoying that period of Doctor Who much either, even though it was Tom. So something was already happening that wasn't pleasing younger people. Because, yeah. I mean, I love Warrior's Gate, but all I remember thinking is eSpace looks like the Blue Peter Studio. It all looks cheap. It's just crap CSO. And like you said, there was something missing, wasn't there? I think some of his points about Douglas Adams I also agree with. I love Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I think the fact that Adams considered his cricket men idea for Doctor Who and that Tom Baker thought it was a great idea, it works as a Hitchhiker's idea. But the fact that that might have actually happened in the Doctor Who universe makes me horrified. And who am I to criticize a genius like Douglas Adams? But I think somewhere in between the Bidmead and the Adams sensibilities is probably the Doctor Who where it should probably live. Or I personally like it.
We are drifting off Cachavalva a little because we're focusing on him.
I think it's hard not to, because it's not a very exciting story.
He speaks of writer after writer, after he's sent them back for the umpteenth rewrite, finally delivering a script marked final draft, I'm off to Greece for a month. You know, in other words, I'm not doing it again. Because he says, you know, a writer will give him a script and he'll go through it with him explaining why he thinks it needs to be changed. Is it a poor choice of writers or poor direction when he's telling them what needs to be changed?
I think writing back then, before the sort of renaissance in the early 90s, where the American model was sort of slowly but surely kicking and screaming brought over to British television, writing back then really was like, I always think of them, the fact that they had to use typewriters and secretaries typing up new versions.
Yeah.
And it's just like, Jesus, I feel ill when I think about not being able to use a computer to write. Like, it must have been so damn hard, no matter how good you were at typing.
Have you heard the story about Terence Dix, haven't you?
Well, he just turns up with envelopes and gives them to Donald Tosh. And Donald Tosh opens them up going, oh, it's not a script, it's a storyline. I mean, when I had dinner with Donald Tosh, he said, you know, one time, Terry Nation is supposed to be delivering some scripts for some Dalek thing for Pertwee. He's on his way to the airport to go to America and just sort of gives him the envelope. And Donald goes, okay. And as the taxi's going away, he kind of goes, this feels a bit light. And he opens it up and it's just a sort of outline.
Did I say Terry Nation? I meant Terence Dix.
Okay, but Terry Nation,
but
yeah.
You've got Terence Dix refusing to redraft a story again for him.
Mm.
And I think this links into this idea, you know, JNT arrives and almost decides, right, I'm not having anyone who's worked for the show before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that fits into what Bidmead's doing here. Is we can't use people who worked on Doctor Who before because they don't fit into our brave new world. I've got a
plan! Yeah, but then they can't write for Doctor Who.
If even Terence, I mean, he quite almost effectively in some interviews describes Uncle Terence as a bit of an old hack,
mm-hmm.
which in a way he is, in that he can churn the stuff out. But if you're going to be dismissing Terence Dix's writing, you've got to be producing a series of superb genius to try and justify it.
I think Bidmead has a sort of arrogance of someone who expects perfection. And then the reality is what his sort of tough new world produces isn't the goods. So all you're left with is his tough process.
I suddenly had my first inkling of the gulf between his dreams and his power.
And the funny thing is, he's given some very, very long... I mean, there was once a three-month interview he gave to DWM. And he... I mean, I don't want to say it took 3 months. It was spaced out over three issues. First of all, he has this way of mischaracterising the Doctor who he's brought in to save. But then justifying those same faults when it's him doing them. But the funniest thing in all these interviews I've read in DWM is he starts early on in the interview saying that he really disapproves of sort of people who will see ideas that someone else has come up with in a script that never got produced. And, you know, they nick those ideas. He thinks that's unethical. He then says, he gets this writer, Chris Priest, who I think was a fairly well-respected science fiction novelist at the time, to write a script for me, and it doesn't come off. And he says, Chris Priest was very taken with the TARDIS, and this was part of the problem. There was a lot of intellectual stuff about a TARDIS within a TARDIS, or two TARDISes together at the same time. And the interviewer then says, what, as happened later in your Logopolis, you mean? And Bigby says, well, if you care to put it like that, yes, I suppose so.
Well, I suppose, Christopher Bidmead, as a scriptwriter, I suppose it's easy for him to be tyrannised by facts.
Let's try and find some nice things about Castrovalva. I did enjoy, where they draw the map of Castrovalva on the back of the mirror. And he says, yeah. Right, show me where this is. And they say, oh, it's there, and, oh, dear. That's really good.
Mm. Yeah. Probably would have liked less of them pushing the wheelchair going into the canal and a little bit more of the characters in the city. Because that's where the sort of really intriguing stuff is.
Yeah, Michael Sheard and Derek Waring are both really good as well. I think their performances are great.
Yeah. And they have a well-written arc and they all do stuff. And that's a particularly good image at the end. It's almost like a zombie movie, isn't it? Where the master's sort of being ripped apart in the dark by his own creations as they sort of close the door. That's a really, really good image. And we haven't even touched on the fact that the portrait is so obviously Anthony Ainley. From the first time you see it, I remember twigging. I think I just remember thinking, well, the master's behind everything and now they're even showing him.
I don't think it's obvious.
No, I didn't either. I think because I wasn't looking for it. And even though the portrait makes it clear he knows who the doctor is before the doctor's been properly introduced. Mm. So that's the master slipping up, isn't it? Because he calls him doctor very early on.
Oh, right, yes.
But I wouldn't have noticed because I would have been too busy being misdirected to look at Shardvan, who's, despite his kind of mostly pleasant urbane manner, there's something quite sinister about him. Not only that, but they've dressed him in black. And the portrait is dressed in white.
Yes.
So, it's very basic, but it worked on me as a 10-year-old.
Honestly, Mark, if anyone would think you hadn't watched The Armageddon Factor, you should know not to be confused by colours like that. See what I was saying about silo thinking earlier? I googled recursion to find out what it actually meant. And I read the Wikipedia entry on it. It's written by someone who clearly has no idea that anyone might not actually already know what recursion means.
Yeah.
So why write a Wikipedia article on it if everyone knows what it is? It's really awful. And then the penny drops. Have you seen the Blue Peter annual where it gradually gets smaller and smaller and smaller?
I don't believe I have, but that's recursion.
We'll post a link to the front cover of that Blue Peter annual in our show notes, as ever. All I'm thinking is that if someone had just, instead of writing anything on that Wikipedia page, just put a picture of it up, I would have instantly understood what recursion means. Here we are.
It's just something getting smaller each time it cycles round, isn't it?
There we are.
There, yeah.
And if we'd had a writer who could have given the Doctor a throwaway line like that, that would just sum it up. Which I bet someone like Bob Holmes could probably have done. And I don't think he would have included the subjects.
He just calls it a time trap, but doesn't explain. Yeah. He doesn't do that extra bit. There's time trap, which is like the very basic version, but doesn't say what the time trap is. And then there's the clever bit, which sounds good. You know, I like the use of the word, recursive occlusion. But then you'd have a sort of explanation, the classic Who equivalent of it's a wibbly wobbly ball of timey-wimey. Recursive matter. You'd explain what it was by a cool, like the equivalent of the classic Leela and Fourth Doctor with the box talking about just something like that that's fun and full of character and silly in the best sense of the word. If you'd had something like that, and we get a hint of that when they're using the back of the mirror and things like that.
I wonder if Logopolis is a BBC version of recursion. The scriptwriter who engages the writer is Christopher H. Bidmead. The writer engaged by the scriptwriter is Christopher H. Bidmead. The scriptwriter who goes through the writer's draft and corrects it is Christopher H. Bidmead.
I think the thing you were saying before as well, Tegan and Nyssa are a really good team in this.
Oh, yeah, they are brilliant.
Which they often aren't. Nyssa especially always seems to get ignored in almost Adric levels by some of them.
She's really capable in this, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah. She does a load of stuff and blows a load of stuff up. And in some ways, it's the beginning of quite a good structured story that gives all your characters something to do, which with that many companions with different skills is bloody difficult, which is another reason not to have that many companions. The Jodie Whittaker era suffered from that.
I did enjoy right at the beginning of the flight to the ambulance to the TARDIS. It's just like a caper film. You can imagine them doing that to the Benny Hill music, can't you?
Yeah.
Especially when, you'll like this, Mark, I'm going to praise Adric. I do like how he distracts the guards by pointing at the stars. Yes. I think he's really good in that. Although I can't quite believe it when Tegan keeps saying, we must go back for Adric. I was really worried about Adric. I can't really believe it.
I also love the stealing the ambulance bit. And I think that whole opening sequence is absolutely brilliant. And there's something really nice and unusual about seeing the TARDIS team grounded in the modern day like that. It's almost like they've jumped into a different TV programme. Also, I think it's worth noting at the time that although it was a wrench to see Tom Baker going, it was really exciting to see a regeneration for the first time properly. Having seen over the last year or so bits in Doctor Who Monthly and stuff about it, and having read about it for a while.
Did you not catch the Perturbator Baker regen?
I have no memories of it. I think I've got a vague memory of the giant spiders.
How old did you be in 74?
Three.
You said you were only one.
It's funny because my first TV memories are of Tom Baker's first season, but they're all kind of abstract. It's not like I remember narratives or anything. It's like I remember a Sontaran head deflating. I remember Tom Baker staggering out of the incubator with his new tie on.
Were you aware of who Peter was?
Yeah, I would have seen All Creatures Great and Small, yeah. I mean, I think every family saw All Creatures Great and Small.
I spent far more time watching this DVD than I thought I would, because I kept pausing it. Because I went, is it actually true that when Adric's in that web, you can see his bits? And I'm sure you can't.
I don't think so.
There's a great line that Peter says in the... And he doesn't say it nastily, but I think it's very funny when he's in the commentary, where Adric's stretched up in this web, sort of spread-eagled. And he says, Matthew acts much better like this, doesn't he? You know, when he's positioned like that and he's unable to clench his hands together in front of him, he acts much better, doesn't he?
He was 18.
And I love the story of him on the Camparis.
What's that then, Doc?
Oh, but apparently the night before the final day shooting on this estate, they're in a hotel and he discovers Camparis. He gets so pissed. You heard this?
The Waterhouse?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I've heard this one.
At the very end, when they just arrived, they're about to get back in the TARDIS and fly away again. They're all standing by this tree. He says his lines, and then when the others get the lines, he just turns around behind this tree and throws up because he's so green. And apparently they were still able to use the scene because the others just very professionally didn't even blink and carried on talking their lines.
Yeah, I did like that the TARDIS was on its side like that.
Yes.
That looks great, doesn't it?
That's a really good image. I like it when the TARDIS does something unusual every so often.
I really liked the whole setup of the actual town of Castlevalva as well. It felt like a real place. Sets, the costumes, you know, it really felt like it had its own proper character. It did come to life. Because a lot of times in Doctor Who, places can just feel like very generic, lots of Jabberlite and walls and things. And it really works for me. I really like that.
Lots of what? Yeah.
Jabberlite, it's what they make all like the cave walls and stuff out of in Doctor Who. There was a lot of it in Mandragora. Another thing I'd like to mention actually is the sound design on it, because when they're in Castrovalva, you've still got in the background, when they're in the courtyard and stuff, you can still hear the constant sounds of bird chatter as if it's just outside the windows. And they very, very rarely do that on any other story and have the interior scenes punctuated by the sound of stuff happening outside the windows.
I wonder if the whole bird sound thing contributes to what you're saying about Castrovalva feeling like a real place then.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do like the fact that they tried to do justice to the whole concept of the Doctor and people running around inside an Escher painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they do it fairly well, considering the budget as well.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that's a big plus, I think.
Yeah.
Right, should we go to marks out of 10?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Ian?
I would say 5.
Oh.
Mark?
I would give it an 8.
Blimey.
Oh, Adric's in it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
He's not in it enough.
But I do wonder sometimes if an 8 for Peter Davison would only be like a 6 for a Tom, if that makes sense. Do you know?
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes if I grade the stories against that other Doctor's or that other era's stories. Because I think I gave 2 Doctors 7, and I think that this is more than 1 point better than the 2 Doctors.
Yeah. I'd have given the 2 Doctors like a 5 as well.
I also think I tend to emotionally mark stories sometimes rather than objectively.
Yeah. So what about you then, Doc?
I think I'd give it a 5.5.
Ooh.
There's really nothing in it that particularly... I quite actually like Peter Davison towards episode 3 where he's in there actually talking to the Portreeve, and he's quite authoritative and confident rather than being a bit sort of wishy-washy. What I must remember to say before we go is the new Doctor Who theme music has been released today, hasn't it? What did we think of it?
It reminded me of the Tennant era music, I thought, a little bit.
Yeah, well, lots of people have... I saw lots of the Warp Warp group that I'm a member of on Facebook. My computer was pinging like crazy with all their different opinions. And a lot of them have detected the TV movie.
Oh, right.
In there. But I don't know enough about music, and I've only heard it once. I remember just thinking, it does remind me of that stirring RTD era.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
It does sound good. And there's some, my main takeaway from my first thing is, oh, there's some lovely French horn.
I think it's got a bit of its bass back to it, which is good, which I think was lacking in the Jodie era. Or if there was bass in the Jodie era, it was so deep and low in the mix that my speakers on my crap telly couldn't pick it up.
The Jodie Whittaker theme is the Kid A of Doctor Who themes. Because it was like, oh, this is really clever. And actually, when you get down to it, it's s*** and muddy and sounds like somebody who's hard of hearing has put it in the mix.
Also, I think we've gotten away from that kind of weird, weedy theremin sound that they had on the Peter Capaldi era as well, which, again, sort of lacked bite, really.
Yeah.
I thought the opening bars, the... that was a bit confused. But when it gets onto the... from then on, I thought it was very good and very thumping and reminiscent of RTDs. Although I'm not sure, perhaps the heavenly choir towards the end might grow on me, I'm not sure.
Now, I was going to say, there is a choral element, isn't there? I really like that. I'm always listening to soprano stuff if I'm listening to classical music. That's what I like.
Right. In that case, Ian, thank you for your company.
That's been brilliant.
Oh, look who's coming. It's the Portreeve. Portreeve, how are you? You're looking a bit stooped over. Hang on, what's this? Is this...
Don't mind me. I'm just here to put some books back in the library.
Let me just take off this toupee. Ah! It's Bernard Mandrill!
Ah, surprise!
Uncle Bernard, I understand you had problems with the way that Segal and Nyssa kept failing to carry the Zero cabinet around the Delaware estate. What was your particular problem?
Don't dump wheelchairs in the river.
Uncle Bernard, we have hungover 18-year-old actors in Sector 47.
It's a f***ing disgrace.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dumb, the empty space that circles time.